From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. And today, represent my people. The midterm elections are fast approaching, so we hear from activists doubling down on voter registration.
I see. And then why you do that? Because I want people to go out to vote. They make me happy. It made me feel like even I don't vote, I can feel like I got a voice now.
And representing on TV, my interview with Cristela, the first Latina to have her own primetime sitcom.
I never set out to do stand-up about my family, to try to get this TV show, and it was never about that. It really was a means of surviving.
Also, what's up with Latino voter turnout, and the web gets some new Latino destinations. All this and more coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, as we represent. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Story about my Guajira.
Guajira, I love you too much. Guajira, I love you too much.
Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Here's a question. Take a moment and ask yourself right now. Do you feel like your government, whether it's federal, state, or local, do you feel like they represent you? Rich Benjamin, author of Searching for Whitopia and a senior fellow at DEMOS, a public policy organization, says that representation has important implications when it comes to race.
In America, we can do better than other racially diverse countries that are balkanized, whereby the vast majority of the population is one thing and the people in power are another thing, which tends to be white or light-skinned. I think we can do better. I hope we can do better. We need to do better. We don't want a situation in this country where representation doesn't look like actual citizens. We do want a beloved community where citizens are equitably represented in the economy and in our political institutions.
A community with equitable representation starts with people from the community running for office. So we bring you three stories now of places in the U.S. where Latinos are doing just that. We start in California, which makes sense since California has far and away the largest Latino population in the country. Erica Aguilar has our report from Anaheim.
Latinos make up more than half of the population here, but no one on the city council is Latino. Ricardo Muniz is a young voter who says the council, all white and mostly affluent, is out of touch.
They don't really know what's really going on in the neighborhoods. So we need to have somebody that really, truly knows.
That's why he's attending a cafecito, a meet and greet, for city council candidate Jose Moreno. He's a professor of Chicano and Latino studies at California State University, Long Beach. Moreno, who's 45, immigrated to California with his family from Mexico when he was four.
En nuestra cultura es importante la relación.
Moreno says residents need someone who speaks their language, someone who can relate. 2 years ago, he worked with the ACLU to sue the city of Anaheim and change the way the city council is elected. Currently, residents vote for at-large candidates who represent the entire city. Moreno's lawsuit asked for the city to create districts so residents can vote for a candidate from their own neighborhood who will represent them.
When people do feel, if they feel like their vote counts, they're going to come out. And we're seeing it. We're seeing that now they feel their vote can count now to change the system.
The city eventually settled the lawsuit by leaving it up to voters in a public referendum to decide if they'd like to create districts. Chris Murray will be voting no. She sits on the Anaheim Council and is up for re-election. She says districts will just divide the city even more.
You stop looking at what's holistically best for your city, just what's best for my little piece of the city.
The race has attracted attention from elsewhere. Political action committees and other groups from San Francisco and Washington, D.C. have funded about a third of the money raised to convince Anaheim voters that council districts would be fairer. They're also contributing to Jose Moreno's campaign to get him on the city council.
Next, we go to another border state, this time Arizona, which has a rocky history with Latinos and school curricula. Jude Joffe Block reports now on an education election out of Phoenix.
Unlike many states, Arizona elects its superintendent of public instruction. And here, the race is about more than the three R's. The current superintendent, Republican John Hupenthal, has made his share of waves. Hupenthal and his predecessor led the controversial move to ban the Mexican-American Studies program in Tucson's public schools. The program ended in 2012, but not without student protest. This summer, Hupenthal was exposed for posting anonymous comments on political blogs. In one, he denounced Spanish-language media, saying, quote, "This is America, speak English." In another, he referred to welfare recipients as lazy pigs.
They are not what is in my mind. They don't reflect the love that is in my heart.
That's him apologizing for those comments. Even so, Hupenthal lost his reelection bid in the Republican primary. Badly. The winner was Diane Douglas, a former school board president aligned with the Tea Party. She has one key issue, stopping the federal standards known as Common Core. Douglas didn't respond to our request for an interview, but here she is at the sole debate she participated in.
The issue of this debate, of this election, is who controls the education of our children. Is it the Washington insiders and the special interests of corporate America, or is it the parents?
Since then, Douglas has declined to appear with her Democratic opponent, David Garcia, a fourth-generation Arizonan of Mexican descent. Garcia says he wants more students to become bilingual. Some analysts speculate it's not in Douglas's interest to debate Garcia, since his education credentials arguably outshine hers. He's a former associate superintendent and an education professor. Unlike Douglas, Garcia supports Common Core. He also talks about reversing high school dropout rates and relying less on standardized tests. He says he can be a role model for Arizona's school-age population, which is majority-minority.
And most of those students are Latinos. And I think it's important that they are able to see their face in the face of their leaders.
Even though Garcia's a Democrat, he's been endorsed by two past superintendents who served as Republicans. They called Douglas's stance on Common Core destructive and too extreme. Political analyst Chris Hurstam says that helps Garcia, since Douglas has the advantage of having more registered Republicans in the state. Hurstam says there's another factor that could work against Garcia.
Let's never underestimate racism in this state.
After all,
the state of Arizona has not elected a Latino to a statewide office for 40 years.
On Election Day, we'll see if that changes.
And lastly, we travel across the country to New England. You don't often think of Latinos in Rhode Island, but in Providence, the state capital, one man is hoping to change that in the mayoral race. Ian Donis has more.
Here, the race for mayor pits one of the legendary rogues of American politics against the son of Guatemalan immigrants making his first run for political office.
Apologize for the weather, but I can't control that. A little cool this morning.
In 2002, Providence Mayor Buddy Cianci was convicted of racketeering conspiracy and sentenced to 5 years in federal prison. So during a recent campaign speech on public safety, Cianci couldn't believe his fortune when someone from a poor city neighborhood offered him a testimonial.
And I remember you, Buddy, doing an awful lot for this community.
Thank you.
And the last time we truly felt safe was when you were mayor. Uh-huh. but I'm not here just for
Did anybody ask you to do that today?
No.
Did I mean, does the president? I haven't seen you in yet.
CNC's latest comeback attempt as an independent candidate is being fueled by nostalgia for the prosperity of the 90s and improvements during his tenure as mayor. The city unions that got generous benefits from CNC all support him, but not everyone does.
CNC's record on public safety is abysmal.
That's CNC's Democratic rival, 37-year-old Jorge Alorza. He's a self-assured law school professor and former housing court judge. He grew up in a poor Providence neighborhood and wound up graduating from Harvard Law School. He's got less money than CNC, but he says he's got the right message to beat a convicted felon.
And when we're talking to voters, what we found consistently is that when they learn about me, when they hear my ideas, when they hear my vision for the city about creating jobs, fixing our schools, and bringing honest leadership, you know, it resonates with them and we win them over.
Although Alorza is Guatemalan-American, most of Rodon's Latinos are Dominicans, and they won't be voting in lockstep in the race for mayor. Yet Alorza has support from the state's top Democrats. Recently, the state's congressional delegation held a fundraiser for him. Not only that, three of Rodon's former federal prosecutors staged a news conference warning Providence voters not to give CNC another chance at City Hall. Most observers expect the race to be tight. For Latino USA, I'm Ian Donis in Providence, Rhode Island.
And now for a bocadito, a little morsel of news. Google recently rolled out a new kind of domain, .soy. And no, it's not soy like in soy milk. It's soy as in I am.
Introducing .soy, a new domain for your identity, your ideas, your business.
They're calling it the place for Latinos online. And .soy is meant to be a place where Latinos can discuss their identity. But reactions online have been mixed. Our producers AC Valdez and Daisy Rosario sat down to talk about the new alternative to .com.
Hey, Daisy Rosario.
Hey, AC Valdez.
Nice to be with you.
Pleasure to be in the booth.
So .soy.
.soy.
So let's define what .soy is. .soy is a new .com, .org, .net, .whatever top-level domain that Google, I think, has opened up for sale.
Yes.
And it's encouraging the bilingual, multicultural, ambicultural demographic.
Yeah. I was looking at Google's website about it, and they talked about the Latino population and just the amount of people that there are in the country that this could appeal to and the companies that have already switched over to .soy. You know, it's an interesting thing because soy means I am.
Right.
It just in Spanish means I am. So you're starting a sentence with it. You're saying what you are. And that's a different kind of end for a web address than most.
Right. Because, you know, usually you think .com. Okay. So it's a commercial website. .org. Right. It's a nonprofit organization.
.edu is a school. I mean, they are what they are, but they have nothing to do with individual
Identity.
Individual identity.
And it strikes me that, like, if they were to do this for any other market segment, if they were to do that for Black folks or for Asian folks,
what would it even be?
It's such an icky thing to contemplate.
So many places that could go wrong.
The other flip side of this is like the militant vegan market.
Yeah, and I think in, you know, depending on what circles you travel in, if you say .soy to some people, their go-to is definitely going to be thinking of soy milk or, you know,
sauce.soy.
Sauce.soy. Daisy Rosario .bacon fat. And I wouldn't have a problem with that. I'd be fine with that. I'd be like, this is a representation of who I am. So maybe it should actually be .soy.
That was Latino USA senior producer AC Valdez and our line producer, Daisy Rosario. Coming up on Latino USA,
the 18 to 30 crowd is far more energetic and far more inspiring than I ever thought to expect from young voters.
Latinos participate in elections at low rates, but is there hope for the future? At least one political scientist is optimistic. Stay with us. No se vaya.
Racismo, blow your head hasta la vista.
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Without any movement whatsoever on immigration reform in Washington, some Latino activists have decided to change their focus. Instead of protesting, activists in Alabama are trying to register every eligible Latino voter in the state. The majority of Latinos in Alabama are undocumented and can't vote, but that doesn't stop them from being politically involved. Ashley Cleek has our story now on people without citizenship who are inspiring people to vote.
Before 2011, Carlos Humberto Ramos Colorado's life was simple. He lived in a small town in Alabama, surrounded by family. He'd started his own bakery. He and most of his family were undocumented, but it didn't seem to matter much. Then, Alabama passed House Bill 56, one of the strictest anti-immigration laws in the nation.
Everybody start talking about what you're going to do about the new law. And I told everybody, don't go anywhere. Nothing's going to happen. Don't be scared.
But Carlos's family was scared and left Alabama. His mom, a sister, and a brother moved back to Mexico. A few relatives moved to Kansas, others to Oregon. That's when Carlos decided to fight. He went to a rally in Montgomery, the state capital, where immigrant advocates and clerics were protesting the new law.
I saw a lot of people screaming, crying, and they singing aside the, how you say that, the consignas chants, yeah. And I heard that, and I said that, okay, I'm not alone. Too much people there.
Carlos started volunteering with a local activist group called Alabama Coalition for Immigrant Justice. At 41, he could pass for an aging hipster, aviator glasses, small black vest, and jeans. He's laid back and deeply earnest, and he's determined to register every eligible Latino voter in Alabama.
4-2, buenos dias, good afternoon. I want to present Fiesta, obviously, today, Fiesta 2014.
At a small park in downtown Birmingham, a Latino street festival is in full swing. There are bands playing and hundreds of people walking around, eating, drinking pineapple juice, and dancing. Carlos is armed with a satchel of voter registration applications, canvassing the park. He goes up to everyone, women and children walking with balloon animals, packs of teenage girls. They could be 18. Carlos is nice, a little pushy, but there are rules. He doesn't ask people if they're citizens, and some people have questions for him.
Why should you do this? Are you already registered to vote? I say, I can vote. You see, and then why you do that? Because I want people to go out to vote. They make me happy. It make me feel like even I don't vote, I can feel like I got a voice now.
Carlos focuses on Latinos, but he'll register anyone and everyone. He goes to bars, high schools. He stops people in parking lots. He even registered the teller at the bank who helped him open a checking account. The hard part, Carlos says, is finding Latinos who are eligible. He says that of 10 Latino people he asks, only one will qualify. Turnout is generally low during a midterm election, and among Hispanic voters, it's minuscule. According to the Pew Research Center, there are about 45,000 eligible Latino voters in Alabama, but only 18,000 are actually registered. And in 2010, the last midterm election, only 1,100 voted.
Can she register to vote? She turns 18 before the election.
I'll think about it. I might. I don't know.
Why not?
Carlos has a lot of work to do to cut through all the voter inexperience and apathy. So far, he signed up about 50 people. Carlos asks a group of men if they want to register. No, they reply, we can't. I can't either, Carlos says. But here's hoping that your kid will be our next Hispanic president. For Carlos, the future is the key. In the U.S., nearly a quarter of the Latino population is under 18. In Alabama, nearly one-third are. And the vast majority are citizens, meaning they will be able to vote. They could be the political voice for Carlos. Politicians should take note, he says.
How many people they deport? How many families they separate? And then this little kid is going to be really mad. I mean, they are mad now. And you could do something about it. You see, you will see. They're going to make a big, big difference.
Even after this election, Carlos says he'll keep going, house to house, finding people who can vote. For Latino USA, I'm Ashley Cleek in Birmingham, Alabama.
Now, I could throw all sorts of statistics at you about Latinos and voting. Frankly, and more specifically, why most of us don't vote. So I'm going to, because these are important numbers to know. In the 2010 midterms, according to Pew, just 31% of eligible Latinos voted. Now, due to population increase, there are more Latinos projected to vote than ever before now. 7.8 million versus 6.6 million in the past midterms. According to the polling firm Latino Decisions, over half, 54% of Latino registered voters said they'd be less likely to vote because of President Obama's inaction on immigration. But that can't be the only reason Latinos aren't showing up at the polls, can it? For a deeper look, here's Latino USA's senior producer, AC Valdez.
First things first, if you want to understand Latino voters and why they don't turn out, first, you need to understand who Latinos are.
Over the course of the last 25 years or so, the percentage of Latinos who identify somewhat or very strongly with a term like Latino or Hispanic has increased up to 75%.
Let me introduce you to Gary.
My name is Gary Segura. I'm a professor of political science at Stanford University and a principal and co-founder of the polling firm Latino Decisions.
Gary and his colleague Matt Barreto are co-authors of a book called Latino America: How America's Most Dynamic Population is Poised to Transform the Politics of the Nation.
So most Latinos see themselves as part of a larger pan-ethnic community. They don't see themselves as just Puerto Rican or just Mexican or just Cuban.
The next step, he says, in understanding who Latinos are is threefold. And a big key to that is what he calls resources. Education.
So people with more education are more likely to vote. Politics is easier for them to understand.
Income.
People with more income are more likely to vote. They have more at stake in the system. They usually have more free time.
And, oh yeah, time.
Time is a key resource. Many people who are blue collar, working class, have to take off of work early or get up extra early in the morning in order to vote because they work an hourly job that doesn't give them time to just go stand in line.
And there's one more factor Gary says is underreported and underestimated.
73,000 U.S. citizens of Latin American ancestry turn 18 every month. And their levels of education are going up. So I think some of these resource disadvantages are going to disappear over time. And I got to tell you, the 18 to 30 crowd is far more energetic and far more inspiring than I ever thought to expect from young voters.
But if you're trying to sell Latinos, even these energetic young Latinos, on voting, those aren't the only things that matter. Because the message isn't the only thing that matters. It's the messenger.
Well, I think every time that we elect another Latina, it helps. It helps those little girls and those little boys in elementary schools who are looking at the Congress and saying, does that person look like me? Does that person represent me?
Our Congress won't be doing its job until our elected representatives look like the America that we were elected to represent. So with a huge number of Latinos and Latinas in this country, we need to increase those numbers.
Thing is, these talking heads, politicians, even Piolín, who spearheaded a major Get Out the Vote campaign, don't really matter to most people. Who will persuade you? Well, they are.
Doctors, our police officers, our firefighters, nurses, and especially teachers. Every time I hear Republicans bash teachers, I think to myself, oh, that is not your path to get Latino votes, because Latinos love teachers. And without a doubt, in a number of different studies we've done, the most important person to get you to vote is your mother. And I can promise you that would be my experience as well.
Right now, the overwhelming media narrative about this year's election is pretty pessimistic when it comes to Latinos. The Wall Street Journal published a headline saying frustrated Hispanics are down on this year's midterms. The New York Times headline read, "Why House Republicans Alienate Hispanics. They don't need them." And Fox News Latino's headline cited a Pew study that said the Latino vote would not be a major factor in these tight midterm races. But Gary Segura's not so sure.
This notion that Latinos don't have any impact on the election is way overblown. If there's an upset of either the governor or the incumbent senator in Kansas, that's going to be on Latinos. If Kay Hagan keeps her job in North Carolina, that's going to be on Latinos. If Charlie Crist replaces Rick Scott, that's going to be on Latinos. And so the idea that Latinos don't matter is a media narrative that works to the advantage of certain key actors, but it's not based on reality.
There's one more thing worth noting. Latinos are just as fed up with politics as anybody else. The U.S. has the most unproductive Congress we've had in, well, maybe ever, and Latino support for President Obama is definitely slipping due to inaction on immigration, among other things. But what do Latino voters get if they walk away?
If they walk away for good in some form of unity, then they get very little. Someone will still be elected, and that someone will not owe their chair to Latinos.
For Latino USA, I'm A.C. Valdez.
To see an interactive map from Pew about the Latino electorate and to learn about potential impact on your state, visit our website, latinousa.org. In San Francisco, there's a tight race for a seat in the California State Assembly. The two candidates have a lot in common. They're both 44 years old, both Democrats, both Harvard-educated lawyers, and both serve on the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. And they even share the same name, David. If David Campos wins, he'll be the first Latino from San Francisco to hold the seat. But if David Chu wins, he'll be the first Asian American. Emily Wilson has our story.
David Campos and David Chu were the two top vote-getters in June's primary election for the California Assembly. That means they face off in November. One key factor in the race will be getting out the Latino vote, which is often underrepresented.
The Latino community, in many respects, like so many communities, is a sleeping giant.
That's David Campos speaking to volunteers in the heart of San Francisco's Mission District, an area with a high number of Latinos.
We are, you know, we are voters, but we're simply not coming out to vote. And for us to be able to take this city back and to really guide it in the direction that it should go, we need to energize these voters and make sure they come out.
In most any other situation, Campos and Chu, who both identify as progressive Democrats, would be allies. But as candidates, they're emphasizing their differences. Chu says he builds consensus, encourages economic development, and gets results. Campos, who is gay, has focused his campaign on income inequality and the rising number of evictions in San Francisco due to gentrification. Campos was born in Guatemala. He says his personal story informs his politics.
Because of the fact that my parents brought me here as a child, undocumented, without knowing the language, no money, and we had to struggle. I love this country because it's a country that has given me so much.
Campos's story resonates with a lot of people in the Mission District. But those voters often don't turn out for a variety of reasons.
You know, a lot of the Latino community are not used to exercising their voice.
That's Eric Arguello, the head of a Mission District Merchants Association.
You know, especially from countries where they've been persecuted for, you know, speaking out. So there's a sense of don't rock the boat kind of thing, keeping quiet.
Other Latino voters, he says, are just trying to get by.
You know, a lot of them are working two or three jobs, raising a family. They don't have time. They're so busy with just surviving that they're not really connected to the politics, you know, and to what's going on.
But David Campos's candidacy might change that. Campos is the first politician to seriously target Latino voters, says Gabriel Medina, the president of San Francisco's Latino Democratic Club.
I've been a campaign manager many times, and I've never, ever seen the level of commitment and outreach that David Campos has done to the Latino community.
San Francisco's Latino population is unique, Medina says, with about half coming from Central America and about half from Mexico. He says Campos is able to gather support from all different segments of the community.
So many different cultures here. We're not one unified culture. We have middle class, we have new immigrants, we have a working class that have been here for a long time, and then from different countries and different language barriers. David Campos, has really kind of galvanized our community in that regard.
Even so, Campos says he doesn't want to focus just on Latino voters, but on all working and middle class voters worried about displacement.
And, you know, I always say to people, you know, this is a campaign that is really not about a candidate. It's a campaign that's about a movement. And it's really a movement to protect San Francisco and to make San Francisco affordable for all of us.
Meanwhile, Campos's opponent, David Chu, says that's what he's worked for as well in his 6 years as president of the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. Chu is the son of Chinese immigrants. He says he brings people together to create jobs and affordable housing.
As an Asian American, I have been honored to work closely with the Latino community as an immigrant rights attorney and as an elected official who has worked to deliver language access, immigrant rights, legal representation for Latino immigrants facing deportation, and to ensure that we have a social safety net that really works for all of our communities, including our Latino immigrant populations.
Chu is popular with Asian voters, but like Campos, he says he will represent everyone.
And we are campaigning in the Mission neighborhoods that have strong Latino immigrant backgrounds. We're campaigning in Chinatown and Japantown and Little Saigon. We're campaigning in our traditionally African-American neighborhoods, as well as in every neighborhood in the city that really reflects the diversity of San Francisco.
In the primary, Chu beat Campos by 5 points. Now polls say the race is too close to call. And these two candidates have one more thing in common. Whoever wins will be breaking new ground. Chu would be the first Asian American from San Francisco in the assembly, and Campos would be the first Latino. For Latino USA, I'm Emily Wilson in San Francisco.
Coming up on Latino USA.
I'm writing it out of truth. It's not that I'm trying to create this agenda. I don't know what you think, but I can tell you what I deal with.
My interview with the first Latina to have her own primetime sitcom, Cristela. Stay with us. No se vaya.
Estábamos los dos mirando el mar cuando la tarde moría. Me quedé toda la noche en la arena. Intenté que algo valiera la pena. No puedo conseguir cambiar ni corregir lo que me corre.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Well, if you read the TV pages and online critics, you know that a Latina on primetime is being touted as the next big thing. Cristela is the first Latina to ever executive produce, write, and star in her own primetime sitcom. Cristela is a stand-up comic who grew up in a border town in Texas and never intended to have her own primetime show. She came up to our studios in Harlem, New York City, to talk about her mother, about being herself, and about why she wants to represent. Cristela Alonso, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here.
And I've always admired stand-up comics because I just think it takes a big pair of ovaries, in your case, to stand up and tell jokes. What made you do that?
You know, growing up, I come from a family. We lived well below the poverty line. We were very poor. Grew up in a border town, South Texas, San Juan, Texas. A million miles away from Hollywood, anything. I always say it's a million miles away from dreaming. You know, my mom came here from Mexico, and her whole life was about survival, getting by, and she always told us not to dream because she didn't want us disappointed. So when we were really young, we had no money, and I didn't realize it till I was older. My mom would use comedy to make us not notice that we didn't have things. So it was her way of entertaining us and keeping us happy.
So what would that look like?
She would make jokes about, you know, old things that we had and how new, you know, people loved new things, but we were so different that we liked old things, you know. It was cool to like old things, you know. When I was a kid, we would go to the grocery store, and for years, and I mean years, till I was about 8 or 9, we'd walk down the cereal aisle, and my mom always said that the boxes were empty. And I wasn't allowed to touch the boxes. And then she would go down the aisle to the big bags of cereal, the ones that, you know, like the 3-pound bags of cereal.
Those you could touch.
Yes. And she's like, that's the cereal that should go inside those boxes. Those boxes describe the cereal that's available at the end of the aisle, you know? And it's funny because
I love your mom.
Yeah,
she was like seriously thinking on her toes.
She was. She was amazing, you know? She was amazing. And, you know, I think that from her, I got my sense of humor. She was very sarcastic. She was very, it was funny. She had a second grade education. And it's funny because people think that when you hear that someone has a second grade education, I think a lot of people don't assume that they're smart, because they don't have the education that people are used to. She was a brilliant woman, though. I mean, she was innovative. The fact that she could make do with so little and make things happen showed how smart she was. So comedy for us was her way of coping with life, with the sad life that we had, that she thought we had. So I always loved comedy because of that. I learned to do comedy when things got difficult. I ended up having to move to Dallas, Texas to help my sister take care of her kids and my mom. My mom got sick. My mom told me when I was 8 or 9 that I was going to be the one responsible for her when she got older. And it was always understood that that was going to be my job. So I had to stop everything that I was doing. I was trying to perform. I was trying to build my career. I had to drop everything and move back home. So when I moved back home, my family thought that I was done trying to chase after this dream, and now it was time for reality. Well, my mom got sick, and I took care of her. She passed away a year after I moved to Dallas, and I found myself so depressed because now I wasn't chasing any dream that I wanted. I'd lost my mom. I didn't know what to do. And my family, not having money, I couldn't afford therapy. I couldn't afford to go to a doctor and see if there was anything to make me feel better. So I used stand-up. So I started doing stand-up to talk about my mom, and it was really therapeutic. And I never set out to do stand-up about my family to try to get this TV show, and it was never about that. It really was a means of surviving. So I started telling these stories about my mom, and I found that everybody got my mom. Everybody knew somebody like her, even if it wasn't their mom, their aunt, somebody that they worked with. The personality was familiar, regardless of being Mexican or not, being Latino or not. The stories were similar. So I started talking more about my family because that's all I knew about. So I started talking more about my sister, my brothers, my nephew, my niece, and more people got into it because they could all relate to these family stories.
When you see other successful comics and you think about the big personalities and you're like, well, now I'm going to get on stage and try to compete with them.
I've always lived off of this idea that, you know, because we grew up poor, I've always been kind of fearless to do things because I had nothing to lose. What was the worst that could happen? I know that anything I try to do with my life, regardless of whether I fail or succeed, I will never be as hungry as I was as a kid. I will never do without things that I did as a kid. Sure, it'll hurt, but the disappointment goes away. Knowing that I tried to do it, that was the best feeling I knew I could ever feel in my life because the last thing I wanted to do is have regret.
So now you get to have a television show and you get to go on to put, for example, this great scene where you go in for the job interview.
Yes.
With this character and it turns ugly pretty fast.
Yes.
Oh, can I toss this in before you empty that?
Is this really happening?
Oh my God. Oh my God. I am so sorry. Obviously you're not the cleaning crew. Can you validate me?
I think you've been validated enough.
Is that liberating to basically just be like, I'm going to tell you what it really is like?
Yes. And you know,
in modern day America, if you're Latino.
I love that you say that because when we got the show picked up, I started doing all these interviews and I saw that a couple people here and there would ask me, why would you think that anybody would ever confuse you for a cleaning lady? Why would you think this?
Are you kidding
me? Oh yeah, all the time. And they always said the same thing. But you were dressed up. Why would anybody confuse you for the cleaning lady if you're dressed up and you look like you belong? That's what they said. And my response was always, well, it's happened to me. I'm writing it out of truth. It's not that I'm trying to create this agenda. I don't know what you think, but I can tell you what I deal with. I can get dressed up in what I think are my best clothes, and I found myself in situations where people confuse me for the help in whatever business I go to. Now, that doesn't make me feel good because I'm wearing the best things I own. Those moments have made me feel bad, you know? And I wanted to show that in the show because I wanted to show that that is something that we deal with. The way that I react is the way I react in life, though. I laugh it off. I laugh it off because I always feel like the moment you laugh at someone, you take away their power because now you're trying to show them that what they said didn't affect you. And that makes them mad.
You do have this smile on during the entire show.
Yes.
You've got this little smile. And I'm like, how does Cristela do that?
The biggest note I got for the show was to just be myself. And that's who I am. And I think that's what you can tell, hopefully, from the show is that you know that what I am in the show is really exactly kind of what I am in real life. Everything I say, I defend to the ends of the earth because what I talk about is true to me. I don't try to assume, I don't make assumptions about anybody. Anything that I talk about has been based on my experience. And I always tell people, as long as you personalize the experience and personalize your journey, no one can argue with that because it's your life.
Now, have people said to you, oh my God, you're the next George Lopez?
You know, I'm fine with it because I know what they mean. They're trying to say that they think I have a shot, but they only refer to certain people that they can grasp to. I did a screening a couple days ago, and this woman after the screening, I did a Q&A, and she said, hey, the mom in your show, that's not my mom. My mom wasn't like that. My mom was a sweet woman who cared for me, went on and on. And I said, that's great. My mom wasn't like that.
Your mom was an angry Latina.
Right. My mom was this woman. I can't write your mom. Like, you know, your mom sounds amazing. I didn't have that mom. You know, but, and then she said, why is it that every time Mexicans get shows, they always have to have the same mom? So you mean George Lopez and me? By every Mexican, you mean both of us.
That's it, right?
You know, it's like all of us, all hundreds and thousands. Mexicans just get shows every week.
So many
week,
TV
every,
shows.
Right now. Yeah.
So many Mexican moms talked, that you can refer to.
I know. You know, the time we've talked, 1,000 Mexicans have gotten married.
Have been on prime time.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and I thought, I told her, I'm like, well, we're both Mexican, and I can't speak for him, but maybe we had the same character. Maybe we had the same mom. I think he was raised by his grandmother. Maybe they were similar characters. But I did tell her, like, see, you're focusing on the older woman. My sister's a mom too. In the show, she's a mother. So it's like you're going after the older woman, the oldest woman in the show. Why aren't you saying anything about the sister character? Because her mothering is completely different from my mom's way of mothering.
So when you were growing up in South Texas, did you feel confused about, am I Mexican? Am I American? Am I Texan? Am I Latina? Were you confused about your identity
definitely.
At all?
Definitely. You know, I
thought you were going to be definitely not.
No,
you're
no,
like,
no. Of course,
yes.
Because I mean, I grew up in the 80s in Texas. Everybody I knew was Mexican. We spoke Spanish a lot. My grandmother lived in Reynosa, Tamaulipas. So we used to go visit her every Monday, which is my mom's day off from work. My life was really it was heavily involving like the Mexican culture, you know. But then when I'd watch TV, everything was American. My mom was strict. We had a lot of gangs in the neighborhood. We had, you know, she wouldn't let us hang out with friends. We were always supposed to go to school, come home, and that's it. We weren't allowed to go out. Because of that, TV became my friend. So TV was the only connection I had to the American life, my version of the American life.
So, Cristela, what does that mean to you when you think about the fact that other Latinos are going to be looking at your show and saying, that's me? Have you thought about that?
That was actually one of my goals with this show. I've always thought about it. You know, it's funny. People always ask me if I'm excited about this show coming out. And I always say no, because I'm too busy working to really accept what's happening. But for me, I always think of my mom. I think my mom is a very typical person's the story of a typical person that's never told. My mom came here from Mexico because in her village, they had no electricity, no water, no anything. Life was really primitive and very rough. And she came here not realizing that by coming here, she was doing such an amazing, heroic thing. You know, she never thought that what she was doing was special. And it blows my mind that she never knew that, because I thought that what she did was so amazing. And I want people to know the stories of families that come from that kind of person. They did so much for us, and they're never appreciated or recognized.
Are you serious? We're going to cry? You've got tears in your eyes, Manita.
I do. Well, because to me, it's just, I really want to tell the story of people like me so that people like me could be inspired and know that they have a shot. I think it's really important to me. I think that's the most important thing about this show for me.
I can't believe it. We're supposed to be laughing and we're crying. Cristela, it's that heart that's going to change everything. So thank you so much for your laughter, for your tears, and for that heart.
Thank you so much.
And good luck with everything.
Thank you.
Cristela's new sitcom, Cristela, can be found on ABC Friday nights at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Time. She joined us from our studios in Harlem, New York City. For today's Sabiduría, or Words of Wisdom, we hear from New York-based illustrator Javier Cruz Winnick. He just released a children's book called A Reason to Smile. We caught up with him at the Javits Center in New York, where he was selling his art and his book at a comic book convention. Cruz Winnick tells us about what inspired him to write his book and what has given him pride.
My name is Javier Cruz Winnick. I am selling my illustrations and telling people about my children's book. It's called A Reason to Smile, and it's about a little girl who's a walking silver lining. Very confident little girl, about fifth grade age, and she does a lot of people watching. And in her people watching, she finds opportunities to help people out. And in helping them, the problems don't go away, but they find an easier way to manage the problems. I was an assistant teacher and an after-school art teacher for about maybe 5 or 6 years. There's a lack of diversity in the market. There's not that many Latin characters that are from America. If you find Latin characters, they're either from somewhere in South America or they're Mexican, and it's about their experience, whereas there's still a lot of Latinos that grew up in America that are underrepresented. So Latinos all together are just underrepresented. So I wanted my character to be a Latino as well. Because I saw a lot of the times the stuff that the kids would want and would take home in terms of like their reading material, it was mostly, you know, what we see in the media. And I wanted to give kids another opportunity to enjoy something that was quality that they would also have fun with. I didn't realize it until I got older, because when I was growing up, that's what I saw. So what I saw was what I thought was reality. And, you know, I always heard the country music playing behind Bugs Bunny. You know, I always saw the white characters in the cartoons. Even in the stuff that was anime, they all looked white. They didn't look Japanese. So I thought that's what it was all about. And then the world opened up, and then I saw that there was more to life than just Caucasians and just country music and just what was being fed to me. So I want to help give more food choices. That's something that's always weighed in my head. So the older I got, the more in touch with my roots I got. It's helped me to be a lot more confident. It's helped me to feel a lot more in touch with my roots and my past. And in going through this journey, it's become a sense of pride, something that I know that I can bring to my kids and help have them see, you know, a future in, as opposed to saying I have to partake in what's being given to me. I can create my own future.
Illustrator Javier Cruz Winnick. And we'll be here representing for you, mis queridos listeners. That's a promise. And I ask you to do one thing. Be sure to check your local PBS listings and the World Channel for our TV show, America by the Numbers with Maria Hinojosa, where we're looking not just at our country's demographics, but importantly, how we're represented. Visit americabythenumbers.org for more information. Check us out online at the World Channel and let us know what you think. In every way possible, we want to hear from you. And that's it for this week. Latino USA is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Camilo Vargas, and Antonia Cerecido. Our engineer is Cornelius McMoyler. Nadia Raymond is our music consultant. Our interns are Laura Calzada and Julia Hsu. Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen, and special thanks this week to Sarah Liu and WBEZ in Chicago. Our show is founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, I'll see you on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and on Instagram, and on americabythenumbers.org. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and by the Marguerite Casey Foundation, dedicated to achieving a more just and equitable society for all, and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
I like that pinwheel. Nice work to him.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Inada, maker of the DreamWave massage chair with body scanning technology and shiatsu point detection. Learn more at dreamwavechair.com. And Lumber Liquidators, offering a variety of sustainably harvested flooring, including pre-finished and stained, at 1-800-HARDWOOD. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. This is NPR.